Okay, this is the third of this year's Tana Lectures. My name is Simon Schaffer. Welcome back. I have a few announcements to make, first of all, before I start. Next week, the Cambridge Science Festival starts, and I wanted to draw your attention to various events in the festival, two in particular, that I think are extremely relevant to and are massively better organized than these lectures. One is at the Institute of Astronomy on Mattingley Road on the 12th and 13th of March, so in 10 days' time, and I quote, renowned multidisciplinary artist Pixelate, I'd kill for that name, his real name is Matthew Applegate, so you can kind of understand, is presenting two performances of a new audiovisual study of the people, machines, and practices involved in astronomical observations across the spectrum. And the show will be followed by questions and answers, certainly by questions. No bookings required, and the two events on the 12th and the 13th of March start at 7:30 and last till 9. Be there. It'll be great. Secondly, there's an exhibition at the library of St. John's College it only lasts one day, on the 13th of March from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. It's kind of a drop-in thing. Which is an exhibition called The Way to the Stars, 700 Years of Astronomy. St. John's has one of the world's great collections of astronomical incunabula, as well as manuscripts and early modern printed material, which will be on show. And since, shamefully, almost none of the material I'm presenting in these lectures relates to that great period in the history of astronomy, you can complement your studies by going there. Finally, on the 26th of March, also at St. John's, there's a meeting in the morning in the Wordsworth Room of St. John's from 10:30 through 1 o'clock around the recently published work of Professor Jürgen Oesterhammel on global history. Professor Sir Christopher Bailey will be in debate with Professor Oesterhammel on writing world history, and that raises a whole series of issues that I wish I was competent enough to address, but which I think bear centrally on many of the themes I'm trying to discuss here. So that's on March 26th in St. John's. Okay, let's start. So this is the third lecture. It's called A Disciplined Eye. In English, when we say you're seeing things, we mean the things you're seeing don't exist. You're just seeing things, we say. That's the theme of today's lecture. In the very first of the Tana lectures, I'll go back to Whitehead's classic argument. Whitehead denounced the bifurcation between what there is in the world, what's real, and what is seen. And he appealed, very interestingly for me, to a specific history of the sciences. When, so Whitehead claimed, he was writing in 1919, what he called transmission doctrines were established that sundered appearances and the world. In previous lectures, I explored those divisions, those bifurcations in Whitehead's phrase, in cases such as the layout of colonial observatories and the antiquarianism of colonial astronomers. Today, my concern is much more direct. It's with the way astronomers transmitted what they saw and the doctrines and practices they organized and held that justified those kinds of transmission. I propose that different forms of transmission go along with different forms of discipline. Discipline is a very useful word for me, not for the obvious reason, but because it refers, in English, both to bodies of knowledge and to forms of regulation. Because it has that double sense, in our culture, discipline has always been mixed up with the puzzles of observation and of surveillance, how disciplines look. And this was especially the case when it was necessary to extract facts from the work of delegates, whether those delegates were hardware or personnel. To quote Michel Foucault, the techniques that make it possible to see induce effects of power, and conversely, the means of coercion make those on whom they are applied clearly visible. This form of regulation, of discipline, was institutionalized, for sure, by the lawyers, businessmen, East India Company hands of the New Astronomical Society of London in the 1820s, and at the same time within novel colonial observatory networks. The neglect of moral discipline, they wrote, may be readily detected in any establishment by a practiced eye in the disorder of the general system. So there's a very interesting relationship in these kinds of views between what we might call extra-mission and intra-mission in disciplinary societies, between systems that imagine the gaze as an active process that emerges from the subject, a view that we still preserve every time we buy our daughter a set of X-ray specs, which in my case is quite often, and those that envisaged a passive subjection of discipline's inmates. Now, this mattered a lot in the metropolis because public astronomy had for a very long time, traded in images like these. European cities in the period of interest were full of shows where the wonders of the heavens were displayed to enthusiastic audiences, often accompanied by sublime music and gaudy rhetoric. And at the same time, astronomical praxis was much displayed in the public popular culture of this period. So these are three very different caricatures of Regency England, Rowlandson, Gilray, Parker, of different forms of astronomical activity. George III eclipsing the comet Napoleon, the passion for the comet of 1816, and a magnificent, and here rather badly reproduced, caricature satirizing the Governor General Lord Hastings, in which a group of disgruntled East Indiamen from Madras are gazing in awe at a strange eclipse over Fort William in Calcutta, bottom right. Now, all of these kinds of images were designed to mix up the categories of astronomy and of art. But the precise relation between artistry and astronomy was ancient and it was troubled. Expert historians of astronomy like Albert van Helden have very plausibly argued that it was exactly the troublesomeness of the relationship between astronomy and art that explains the otherwise surprising fact that whereas Galileo's first publications in telescopic astronomy, the first publications in telescopic astronomy of 1610, are rather lavishly illustrated, later works by Galileo are not. The claim is, I'm no expert, that it was the fear that the new science be understood as mere artistry that dominated Galilean concerns, and that fear lasts. The witty Oxford astronomer Herbert Turner told readers of his magazine The Observatory of his temporary panic when he saw in a London shop window a book labelled Astronomy as a Fine Art, and then his enormous relief when he realised that the bookseller had missed out the letter G. You see what was going on there? Are we with gastronomy as a fine art? I'm going to work on this one. So how is it backstage? Backstage, astronomers are artful folk. This is a page from William Herschel's Nebula book of the 1770s. This is a record of his first observation of the nebula in Orion, saw the lucid spot in Orion's sword. Now, the reason I'm showing you this note is not because it's real time, because it's not. He must have had this written up the following morning, but because we start to see the role that a certain kind of literary discipline is always already playing in what he records. He wants immediately to know whether the shape he sees through an extraordinarily good and powerful 7.5 reflector is like the shape of Orion, as, quote, Dr. Smith, that's Robert Smith, Master of Trinity, great Newtonian optician and astronomer of the earlier 18th century, has delineated it. And it matters to cosmology, William Herschel immediately goes on to say, because from this we may infer there are undoubtedly changes among the fixed stars. In other words, Smith's delineation is taken as fiduciary. It's not because Smith was wrong, it's because Orion has changed in 60 years. Similarly, disciplinary power works in the artistry of astronomy because there are many different kinds of astronomy in our period. These are two stunning images of the comet of 1843, made at the Cape of Good Hope by my hero, Charles Piazzi Smythe, possibly the greatest astronomer artist of the 19th century, as you can see. These are two images now owned by the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. And I show you here a citation from Piazzi Smythe's diary in which he's grumbling, comma, as usual, comma, about his boss, Thomas McClear, who's ordered him not to describe how the comet looks, but only where it is, as a result of which Piazzi Smythe's reflecting telescope has been confiscated and put back in the basement where the slaves sleep. So, discipline and art. But the argument that I want to develop with us today that matters most is that the relationship between discipline, art, and vision matters most, perhaps, because of the effect it has on the triage of persons. That's to say, it discriminates, it allows astronomers and their allies to discriminate between types of person. For example, and perhaps most importantly, meridian astronomers, who were our concern 2 weeks ago, explained to many audiences how the disciplined seeing of stellar transits worked, and they always drew contrasts between the different kinds of gaze astronomy involved. Sometimes, I'm showing you the great transit instrument at the Royal Observatory at Greenwich, and a quotation from Walter Maunder, one of the Greenwich astronomers. You see here the distinction, which is effectively moral, if not ethical, between two different kinds of astronomical observer, quick and impulsive, phlegmatic and sure. And to go to the head of the Royal Observatory system, George Airy, who in this really important lecture that Elizabeth Green has analysed very well in her book on the optical diseases of great Victorian scientists, he makes the argument that I'm going to show you, I paraphrase, what I see when I have a migraine. This is an astronomer's drawing of the effects of a migraine, then called hemiopsy, and the insistence that it is to the habit of attention to such sensorial impressions that I attribute my having been led to notice that class of phenomena which, from their inconspicuousness, escape the notice of most people, losers. This kind of distinction matters most, however, to the problem of trust, of the trustworthiness of the inscriptions generated at the eyepiece of telescopes. This again is Maunder, an expert eclipse hunter around the British Empire in the late 19th century, writing here, this is a magnificent drawing he commissioned of the solar eclipse at Buxar in central India in 1898, and his remark about how one is egotistical about one's own sense impressions. Every sketcher of any practice feels his own work to be the precisely true representation of what he saw. If another sketch differs but by a hair's breadth, so much the worse for the other sketch. We can no more help feeling the other man is all wrong, even if the other man is a lady or a camera, than we can fly. Maunder put that into practice. I'll be talking about this episode next week, when he became involved in the late 1890s in the great controversy about whether there are canals on the surface of Mars. What Maunder did here, imitating Christian Huygens in the 17th century, was to get a group of schoolboys, in this case from the Greenwich Naval Academy, to draw the planet without canals. Every child, as you see in these diagrams, involuntarily introduced patterns of lines, canals, into the copies that they made. So, Maunder insinuated, those who saw canals were no better than children, and it was a transmission doctrine about visual prejudice which did the work. We can't assume what we're able to discern is really the ultimate structure of the body we're examining. You're just seeing things. Now, in the balance of the talk, I'm going to look at three great astronomical practices of the period 1780 to 1880, inscription, transit recording, and resolution, in sites of colonial significance in the Pacific and Egypt, in southern Africa, and in Western Ireland. And the material I'm going to describe covers the period from the imperial meridian through to the moment when internal and constructive imperialism begins to develop. The first episode I want to discuss is the British entry into the Pacific in force in the final decades of the 18th century. And the area that I'm interested in is what's now called, rather ethnocentrically, it must be said, the Pacific Northwest, which is in fact, of course, the Pacific Northeast. The area where both the Malaspina expedition of 1791 and Vancouver's great surveys of 1791 to 1794 were carried out. These projects of British and Spanish entry into the central and northern Pacific of the late 18th century have become classic topoi for art historical, colonial historical, and science historical analyses of the practices of inscription. The most important analyses of these practices, of course, come to us from what's now called actor network theory, Michel Calon and Bruno Latour's work, which urges the importance of the fact that these voyagers from Europe were able to make immutable and mobilizable inscriptions which could be combined and recombined at metropolitan centers of calculation, so that it was, to paraphrase Bruno and Michel, as though voyagers were always arriving in the Pacific for the second time. Michael Bravo, who's with us today, has written a magnificent critique of this argument, and I want to follow some of his insights to make trouble for a story which has inscription as effortless as the official actor network theoretic story might make it seem. First of all, simply to emphasize the self-consciousness of artistic inscription at this period. There are several ways of doing this. One is, and this is one of my favorite examples, to insist on the way in which artists often put themselves into the picture. So here are two images of the same scene on what I feel we should call the Malvinas Islands during the Malaspina expedition. This is in 1794. This is a magnificent image now in the Naval Museum in Madrid, which I owe to my friend Juan Pimentel, one of the great historians of the Malaspina expedition. And what you see is the same sort of experiment as the one I showed in the first lecture, in which the figure of the earth is being determined by measuring the length at which a pendulum beats seconds at different latitudes on the earth's surface. And you see the commander of the expedition and two of the scientists, and to the left, one of the great symbols of European entry into the Pacific at this time, the observatory tent, suspended just off the ground to contain the astronomical instruments. But there's another version of this image in which the artist puts himself in and leaves the tent out. And the artist Juan Ravenet, in his gloss on these images, insists on the fact that we are not to trust either of them as accurate representations of this extremely troubled experiment. It was the problem of accuracy, not naturalism, of trustworthiness, not imitation, of reference, not representation, that mattered for these kinds of inscriptions. This mattered most in the story I'm interested in here, in the Vancouver project itself. Vancouver's naval mission in Nootka Sound in the North Pacific was ordered by the administration of William Pitt and Henry Dundas, in other words, the same people who organized the McCartney expedition 2 years later, in October 1790, to master these coasts of the Americas through astronomically based surveying against Spanish threats and for imperial and commercial purposes. Juxtaposed here, a splendid London cartoon of Pitt and Dundas fishing for whales off Nootka Sound with a whalebone club, one of the prides and joys of the collection, the Swain collection, made on the Vancouver voyage, held in the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology here in Cambridge, simply to remind us that you don't have to be European to make very fine inscriptions. The point about the Vancouver project was that it carried the most detailed disciplinary survey instructions the British had ever, up till then, produced. The surveys that Vancouver's men were to conduct were supposed to be exemplary of high precision instrumental vision. So when the Astronomer Royal, Neville Maskelyne, had fairly sadly to report to his father the death of the young Cambridge-trained astronomer William Gooch, who was on the expedition in 1793, Maskelyne, in his characteristically callous, scarcely post-traumatic tone of voice, wrote, "Sir, the whole benefit we expected from sending him out is lost, as the observations made previous to his arrival at Nootka Sound relate only to places which were settled before," unquote. The point about that is not to illustrate the callousness of Astronomers Royal, but rather to point to the ambiguity in the word settlement. In the vocabulary of British astronomers and surveyors, the word settlement is used for the determination of a position by astronomical survey and by possession. Those are the same gesture and the same term. No special analytic distinction was therefore made between writing notes and making images, nor between ciphers, pictures, and other signs. The Royal Society's well-known instructions to Captain Cook in 1768 therefore significantly include lengthy instructions to the captain to find out whether Pacific Islanders, and here's the key phrase, have any method of communicating their thoughts at a distance, as the Mexicans are said to have done by painting and the Peruvians by quipu. The source for such views was, of course, a very common Enlightenment hierarchy that put Aztec ideographs at the bottom of a scale whose summit was occupied by the arbitrarily instituted characters of Chinese. Distant communication of inscriptions between travelers and islanders worked both ways. Cook and Vancouver were supposed to leave what were called marks and inscriptions, which will remain as traces and testimonies of your having been there. But Polynesians saw what British astronomers were doing as making inscriptions too. So this is the letter diary from the tragic William Gooch, recording his encounter in the Marquesas, north of Tahiti, in March of 1792, with the chief Tainai, who came on board his ship, the Daedalus. One of them, that's Tainai, seeing my pen and ink, laid down on the deck on one side and wished me to tattoo his hip, but I did not undertake the task. Tatau, which is a Polynesian word, is rapidly from the 1770s introduced both into British vocabulary for inscriptions on bodies and is used in many Polynesian languages for writing. So this is what Gooch saw on deck. This is Tainai drawn by Gooch. It's been persuasively argued by Alfie Gell, a great anthropologist, that Marquesan tattoos, these kinds of tattoos, are, and I quote, signs which multiply vision and knowledge. They are part of the technology for the creation of subjects and hence the reproduction of social relations. So when, on seeing Gooch write, they deemed it tattooing, they were absolutely correct. Let me move on to the kinds of... I'll skip that. Let me move on to the kinds of devices... Sorry, I've gone too far now. There we go. ...that Gooch was wielding when he was taken to be tattooing. The protocol he was made to sign at Greenwich before he left for his fatal voyage was a standardized document. Every astronomer on board these ships was instructed in just the same way. They were to train their fellow officers in lunar methods of finding longitude. On land, they must set up the tent observatory. They must use the standardized pendulums to calibrate clock rates. They must keep their records in a clear, disciplined, distinct, and regular manner. It seems that the making and dispatching of these inscriptions helped figures like Gooch become astronomers. And there's one of the queries one might enter to actor network theoretic models of inscriptions. The inscription's reliability makes these people into reliable delegates at least as much as the disciplined performance of inscription makes their knowledge into something that can act at a distance. I think the argument is all the wrong way round. As several scholars have argued, this must draw our attention to the inscriptions made on the instruments themselves, on these devices such as sextants and quadrants. It was exactly in this period, as Nicky Reeves has pointed out in his work, that the production of such devices becomes mechanized. I'm showing you on the left the great London instrument maker Jesse Ramsden with his right arm on his dividing engine, the machine that allowed the production of sextants in unprecedentedly large numbers, unprecedentedly quick. And the great dividing engine made by Ramsden's colleague and rival, John Troughton, in 1778. But as Reeves and others have also insisted, the introduction of these machines doesn't get rid of the role of the eye and hand in making the inscriptions on the edges of these astronomical instruments on whose reliability their entire performance relies. Instrument makers still engaged in what they called coaxing. They still insisted on a steady hand and a good eye. And these kinds of techniques were transferred colonially to everyone on shipboard. This mattered much, for example, in possibly the most famous of the astronomical observations of the period, the observations of the transit of Venus made at Fort Venus at Matavai Bay by Cook and his colleague Charles Green in 1769, especially when they for the first time detected what's called the rather mysterious black drop effect, that the planet bleeds across the edge of the sun as it moves across the sun's face. Maskelyne, as usual, was rather intolerant of the problem. Your observations differ more from one another than they ought to do, or than those do made by other observers with instruments of the same size and made by the same artist, the cause of which, comma, if not owing to want of care and address in the observer, comma, masculine use commas the way most people use bullets, I don't know how to assign. And Cook, as David Turnbull has pointed out, was furious with this denunciation. The reality of phenomena like these hinged on the reliability and discipline of personnel and hardware on such projects, hence the desperation and the fragility with which officials sought to impose on long-range delegates and their inscriptions the rules of good order that might then guarantee reliable exchanges and surveys, the communication of ideas at a distance. Let me now move on from late 18th century hydrography to the classical age, as we must call it, the late 19th century work, later 19th century work on transits, on Venus transits. So here is a Punch cartoon of the Venus transit of 1874. Venus is literally transiting in the usual rather literal-minded way that Victorian cartoonists working for Punch had. And a citation from Piazzi Smythe's slightly jaundiced description of the hardware internationally mobilized to make the collective project of transit observation work. One of the most important problems that issues like the black drop and simply timing, in other words, coordinating hand and eye, in making these transit observations worldwide raised was the problem of what came to be called the Personalgleichung, the personal equation. The fact that between 1796 and 1844, a variable was identified, the specific time to be added or subtracted from each observer's measurement of a transit to aid its reduction to common measure. The causes of this variation divided humans, reintroduced ethics into colonial astronomy, and separated disciplines. This is the quasi-mythological origin of the existence of the personal equation. In 1796, Maskelyne again fired his assistant David Kinnebrook because of what Maskelyne called a vicious way, with or without the T, of observing that differed by as much as 800 milliseconds from his own. Modern analyses by Cambridge experimental psychologists reveal that the difference between Maskelyne and Kinnebrook was probably a combination of what are called prior entry and attention switching effects, since the method used, as I've explained to you, combined watching a star with listening to a clock's beats. It's also due to Kinnebrook's habit of rounding off his timings to the nearest integer, which is pretty catastrophic if you're a precision astronomer. But perhaps above all, it's been attributed to the fact that the discontented Kinnebrook resented being married off by Maskelyne to the niece of a visiting Cambridge professor. It happens, right? In the Imperial Meridian, these errors were understood as moral laxity. They could perhaps, and this is the technique that Greenwich tried, be managed by automating, by literally electrifying the process of recording a time, so switching from having to listen to a pendulum beat to pressing a button which would start and stop a rotating barrel chart recorder. But this had absolutely no effect on the disciplinary moralization of the way in which observation should work. The large differences, writes one of the astronomers, existing between observers are not due to physiological constitution, but almost entirely to false habits of observation. Amateurs who lacked these kind of high-tech recorders, and women, and aliens, were all thus ruled out of the community of reliable observers, precisely because time sense was judged by post-Kantians as a privileged mode of access to inner mental states, so therefore superior to space perceptions, the practical techniques of disciplined observatories proved invaluable in the construction of psychodynamics. And as I explained in question session 2 weeks ago, in that sense, in precisely that sense, the first experimental psychology labs of the 1860s through the 1880s in Germany, in Paris, and on Mill Lane were meridian observatories without stars. For this reason, when astronomers travelled to the colonies, quote, they went out ticketed with their personal equation, their senses drilled into a species of martial discipline, their powers absorbed so far as possible in the action of a cosmopolitan observing machine, unquote. This reference to martial discipline is not a facile metaphor. Delegates on the great colonial transit expeditions were typically made up of sappers and gunners, volunteers in the old World War II joke, who'd all spent 3 months in autumn of 1874 in Greenwich Park working with instruments like the one illustrated here, and an artificial model of the black drop, that's what you can see, to assess what Airy called their astronomical fitness, unquote. Newspapers compared this model rehearsal with, as you see here, the principle which induces military commanders to organize sham fights as preparations for the real battle. And indeed, the model you see was built by an artillery officer, George Tupman, who led the expedition to Hawaii at the end of 1874. These are therefore military expeditions in every sense. This is an Illustrated London News image of the expedition to Cairo in December of 1874, bringing the telescopes and clocks up the hill from the city to the Mokattam Range just to the east of Cairo. And this is where they set up. So you see the city, you see Al-Falaki's observatory at the top of the map, the Observatoire Khedivial, and the use of Piazzi Smythe's, I have to call it now, Piazzi Smythe's Great Pyramid far to the southwest as the sight line for the transit observations, and the remark by the commander of the Venus expedition in Egypt in 1874, Colonel Charles Ord Brown, O.E., that he was, quote, struck by the exact similarity of the whole process to the model observation work. Look a bit closer, however, and we see how fragile but how significant this discipline is. Ord Brown had to make sure that things would not go wrong if there was a sandstorm during the transit. My wife will touch me in unison with the beats of the clock, unquote, he told Airy. Why? One of his lieutenant's sisters, Miss Newton, turned out to be impressively reliable, especially, as Ord Brown put it, given she's female, unquote. She was curious about logarithms. She wasn't interested in bonnets. She was never shy. Her personal equation made her 830 milliseconds faster than Ord Brown. I'm a late observer, so her data appears in print. Observers whose data does not appear in print include the head of the Egyptian observatory, our friend Mahmoud Al-Falaki. He's an Egyptian and has all the faults of that tribe, Ord Brown wrote. When the dowager of the Khedive made a drawing of the transit from a very good viewpoint on the roof of the harem, Ord Brown remarked that while it will be valuable to have the impression of a Circassian lady of unprejudiced mind, I love the ambiguity of impression in that sentence, the result is very quaint, like a scene painting. Give it to your daughter as a souvenir. Now, these transit projects did not succeed in establishing a newly accurate value for the astronomical unit. What they did was to embody the program to establish constants of time and position, and to show the intimate connection between the construction of technologies for disciplining individuals and the work of the trained eye, whether applied to Ares' Venus transit program in Egypt or the more ambitious forms of vigilance exercised by Piazzi Smythe at the pyramids that we discussed last week. These were exceptionally perspicuous examples of the kind of martial discipline, fragile, uneven, but fiduciary, required to make reliable astronomical delegates and observations too. The final example that I'm going to discuss in any detail is the problem of resolution, the classic problem of extra-meridian astronomy in the 19th century. Colonial enterprises massively prompted the reorganization of vision in what Thomas de Quincey calls not the astronomy, the astronomies, well beyond the scope of measures of coastlines, of transits, and of star positions. These other extra-meridional astronomies, observing comets, as we saw in the Piazzi-Smythe case, but above all the study of nebulae, involved many fundamental developments in the new disciplines of seeing and of training. The discipline of manufacture, in particular, changed astronomy completely. The huge reflectors built in Britain from the 1780s became the emblems of the unprecedented enterprise of investigation into the construction of the stellar heavens. Big mirrors like those William Herschel built from the 70s and 80s, and again, this is a real-time drawing by Herschel of one of the nebulae as he saw it on the 11th of November 1776. Big mirrors could offer unprecedented light grasp and better images of distant stars and nebulae. Herschel, understandably, describes seeing as an art. Herschel, the natural historian of the heavens, as he calls himself, is unusually explicit about the artfulness of the new discipline of nebula seeing. I can't do the accent. I don't suppose there are many people who could even find a star with my power, much less keep it if they'd found it. Seeing is in some respects an art which must be learnt. To make a person see with such a power is nearly the same as if I were asked to make him play one of Handel's fugues on the organ. Herschel was, of course, a great organist and composer. Many a night have I been practicing to see, and it would be strange if one didn't acquire a certain dexterity by such constant practice. And that dexterity was to a certain extent hereditary. William Herschel's son John, very familiar, takes the family reflectors to the Cape of Good Hope in the 1830s because of the necessity of redrawing the nebulae, including the Magellanic Clouds and Orion. These changes mattered a lot because the Herschels invented a nebula hypothesis, the claim endorsed by materialists that this solar system, and in principle all solar systems in the universe, evolved from primordial clouds of luminous spinning fluid by natural law alone. From the 1840s, materialist evolutionism, as espoused, for example, in the anonymous Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, went along with this kind of story about the nebulae. That meant that evolutionary materialism had as one of its principal pieces of evidence the existence in the heavens of real clouds of nebulous fluid. And there would be two signs that a nebula was such a cloud. A, it would change shape comparatively rapidly, as we saw in William Herschel's notebooks, the idea that Orion had changed shape between the 1730s and the 1770s, given its immense distance, meant that it must be a cloud of fluid and not a much more distant cloud of stars. Secondly, and more importantly, resolution. If one increased the power of one's reflector, did the cloud of light resolve itself into point-like stars? If so, then evidence for nebulous fluid would be undermined, and so would evolutionary materialism. The Herschel project at the Cape was therefore simultaneously colonial. I'm showing you here one of the many explicit colonial eulogies to Herschel's project, but it was also related strongly to the production of evidence for real nebulosity. The strangeness, the capriciousness of the forms of nebulae, this is a page from John Herschel's notebook looking at the Magellanic Clouds, was absolutely crucial in arguments about whether there really is true nebula fluid in the heavens. And that meant the system of transmission from drawings like these to images like these — this is one of the artistic masterpieces of the mid-19th century, after all — this is designed to convince you that this is a cloud of light. The quote is from the assistant astronomer at the Cape, Charles Piazzi Smythe, describing the mechanisms for making images like this, lithography, and the fact that it's a direct positive, it's white on black, and how difficult it is to make such an image, given that — it's a lovely quote from Smythe — our aim is, or ought to be, not the imitation, but the rivalship of nature. So the question was, could images like this be subject to disciplinary control when they were brought home and used polemically in debates about the nebula hypothesis, evolution, and the existence of luminous fluids in the heavens? This is Thomas de Quincey's review of John Herschel's image of the Orion Nebula, printed in an Edinburgh magazine after a pretty opiated evening in 1844. This to emphasize the sheer difficulty of controlling interpretation in the public prints. In a beautiful piece of evocative high romantic prose, De Quincey, as I say, in 46, moves rapidly from a dramatic vision of the Orion Nebula as Herschel and Smythe had made it, to the sublime head of Ramesses II, recently brought from Egypt to the British Museum, thence to reflections on the primal scene, on the Miltonic fall, and on the politics of Orientalism. We shouldn't, it seems to me, be surprised to find this kind of luxuriant language and dramatic imagery in literary and visual responses to images like these. Astronomers engaged in them too. Here is a passage, I think, directly comparable from Herschel's own notebook about three nights after he'd set up the family's 20-foot reflector at the Cape and looked at something as apparently banal as the moon. And I quote from Herschel: "As the moon rises, it presents a round, dull, blotchy human face with broad nose, sulky mouth, and standing perpendicularly has just the effect of some preternatural being, demon, or god of some barbarous nation looking down on his African territory and sniffing with sullen pleasure the scent of some bloody rite, or looking down on the whole region as a scene of carnage agreeable to his nature and will. The European face is quite lost." Unquote. The astronomical point here is, as you will know, that in the southern hemisphere, the moon is seen inverted. But there are many other messages being conveyed by that kind of astronomical scene. So we need finally, I think, to reflect on how to make sense of these astronomical images of nebulae and of the disciplines that surrounded them. It's as though we need to identify what Michael Baxendall called the period eye with which the senses of astronomers were entertained, and their publics too. The achievement of reliable astronomical images depended on forms of admittedly fragile moral, practical, and aesthetic discipline, which were often used to defend political, moral, and religious interests in very dramatic form. It's no coincidence, therefore, that these debates and concerns about the forms of nebulae and whether they can be resolved flourish in a world of cheap print, with the development of the steam press from 1814, and as Jim Secord has so well analysed for us, the development of practices like stereotyping from 1827, which allowed the mass manufacture of images and words by casting off metal impresses of type, which accelerated in their turn widely accessible graphic work and rapid capital concentration. It was in new journals like the Illustrated London News that exploitation took place of these juxtapositions of letterpress and engraving to create unprecedentedly large markets for their remarkable images of improving knowledge, including knowledge of the visible heavens. And unsurprisingly, too, the place where these technologies and disciplines were most intensively tried out in the mid-19th century was, of course, Ireland. Especially the Ireland of the famine. Ireland was subject to internal colonization in its most developed, its most publicly controversial, its most widely debated form. It's inevitable, perhaps, that the most telling iconographic and scientific answers to the dangers of evolution and of the nebula hypothesis and of images of the Orion Nebula came from there. The Earl of Ross, whose estates were specially badly affected in the famine, and who had his own extraordinarily harsh recipes for curing Ireland's ills, death and emigration, there commissioned his huge new reflecting telescopes, mainly to challenge stories that there really is luminous nebula fluid in the heavens. With vast telescopes, including the six-foot mirror the Earl commissioned in 1842, called, from my point of view, extremely satisfactorily, the Leviathan of Parsonstown. With those weapons, the Earl and his team set out to, quote, put up a reflector on Irish principles, to do down Scottish materialism. They preached against the tyranny of unbridled democracy and the catchpenny nebula images the radicals touted, and they recruited powerful allies. What's important for my argument is two features of their nebula resolutions and one intriguing punchline. The first feature is that almost every image of Ross's great industrial achievements are accompanied by detailed texts emphasizing the unprecedented discipline to which Ross's workforce was now subject, in contrast to the un- or indisciplined Irish. So if we look again at the... Sorry, I've gone the wrong way. If we look again at the Illustrated London News, this is the first story of the building of the Leviathan. It's remarkable that it's an Irish earl placed at the centre of an island where still reigns so much poverty and ignorance who has made such progress in this difficult and important task. All these gigantic constructions have been executed in Lord Ross's workshops by persons taken from the surrounding peasantry who, under his teaching and training, have become accomplished workmen, combining with high skill and intelligence the yet more important requisites of steady habits and good conduct. So the Leviathan of Parsonstown was a moral classroom. It's what Piazzi Smythe, one of Ross's biggest fans, called an Irish textbook for Irish peasants, unquote. Secondly, the problem of resolution. The whole enterprise at Parsonstown depended on a trustworthy image-making project in which one would show that what one thought was a luminous cloud of fluid, reasonably nearby the Earth, was in fact an immeasurably distant cloud of stars. That with this newly disciplined Irish workforce and this triumph of ascendancy engineering could be shown to be a distant galaxy. So many descriptions of the labour process, as here, of making such observations, and really dramatic announcements by Ross and his colleagues of successful resolutions. This is a photograph, and a good one, of Thomas Romney Robinson, head of the observatory at Armagh, leader of the Ulster Ascendancy, and really director of the Parsonstown Observatory too, right through the 1840s and 50s. And I juxtapose here two characteristic Romney Robinson speeches in Dublin, one of which insists that all nebulae that the Leviathan has observed have been resolved into stars, and a second speech given the following night insisting on the moral and religious virtues of the ascendancy and above all of Ulstermen. Now the reason, this is the coda, why this is such a dramatic combination of moral discipline and visual discipline is that it's not now thought that the Orion Nebula is stellar. So the largest reflecting telescope in the world between the 1840s and the early 20th century managed to resolve into stars an object we cannot now resolve into stars. Practitioners at Parsonstown were, of course, well aware backstage of these problems. This is a lovely drawing made in Cambridge in 1845 at the British Association for the Advancement of Science of the Earl of Ross on the left and an unnamed lady, captivated, on the right, and drawings from Parsonstown being discussed. And the quote is from a letter home from Cambridge to Robinson from Ross, admitting that these resolutions may be pushing it a bit. The eye may in some degree be influenced by the mind, says the Earl. I've rather naughtily juxtaposed this with a soiree at the British Association. This is one of the results, again, an extraordinary late mid-Victorian artwork, of the Parsonstown project. So this is the central region of the Orion Nebula. Just to show you, if I can do this, what they've done. It's the very, very central bit of this. It's that zone. Okay, that zone in the Leviathan looks like this. And the letterpress that goes with it, on the one hand, concedes that the engraving can't do justice to the successful resolution, and on the other hand, in debate with colleagues, gives a working criterion of what counts as a resolution. And you see that the criterion is essentially tautological. If a nebula is resolvable, it will offer the same appearance on any occasion when the images are sufficiently favourable. But in ways familiar to the sociology of science, we will know that the images are sufficiently favourable because on those occasions the nebula will be resolvable. So if and only if one already accepts that, for example, Orion is in principle resolvable, will one know that this is a favourable evening for viewing. If, on the other hand, you differ in some fundamental way about the nature of the nebula hypothesis and nebula fluid, you'll never accept the resolutions from Parsonstown. And that's what happened. As usual, again, as sociology of scientific knowledge would predict, the what we might call astronomers' regress is broken in London by the introduction of a completely new and completely unanticipated astrotechnology, the technology of the spectroscope. This is the observatory of William Huggins, the wealthy retired grocer of Tulse Hill, who in the 1860s introduced some of the most successful spectral analysis of stellar and nebular light. If a light source is nebula, then it should generate a continuous. Sorry, it should generate a line spectrum. If a light source is stellar, it should generate a continuous spectrum. And as you see, Huggins, reminiscing about this great moment, puts his eye to the spectroscope. This is obviously a rational reconstruction. Looks into the instrument, no spectrum such as I expected, a single bright line only. The riddle of the nebulae was solved, not an aggregation of stars, a luminous gas. So from the 1870s, objects like Orion are calibrated against astrospectroscopy. Two punchlines. New kinds of disciplinary seeing solve this problem. It doesn't escape the kinds of challenges, colonial, visual, and disciplinary, that I've been talking about in this lecture. And these, on the other hand, these new visual technologies don't escape imperial and colonial politics either. This is Piazzi Smythe reacting to astrospectroscopy, linking once again the lessons of starlight and sunlight to the problems of famine and welfare. The sun, as revealed through the spectroscope, fights against the Irish Land League. We're in the 1870s. Next week, I'll explore the new technology of astrospectroscopy and solar physics in the case, particularly, of famine and political economy, in my final lecture, mainly thinking not about Irish, but about Indian famines, and trying to show ways in which the new astronomy of the end of our period, the late 19th century, went along with new imperialism. But for now, that's all, folks. Thank you. Thank you, Boyd. Yes.
I was wondering if you see a shift in sort of the place of individual physical prowess in astronomy this is a bit earlier in this section, but between the introduction of the telescope and previous to the introduction of the telescope. I think the classic hero who should have deserved some mention in this section was Hevelius, who had apparently exceptional eyesight.
Yeah.
And do you think the introduction of the telescope really just destroyed the need for exceptional individual ability like that?
Mm. So, sorry, this is for the podcast. The question was, does the introduction of the telescope introduce the euthanasia of the highly skilled observer? And I should have mentioned Hevelius because his eyesight was so great, right?
His astronomical fix.
Yes, yes. Okay, that's a very, very interesting question. The answer to the first part is certainly no. Part of what I've tried to talk about today and 2 weeks ago is that all these devices work precisely by relying on distributions of tacit embodied forms of skill. I've emphasized again and again ways in which the role of the particularly skilled hand, the particularly skilled eye, indeed the particularly skilled sense of hearing in the case of the eye and ear method, are absolutely fundamental for any effective astronomical observation right through the period that I've been talking about. So the one reason why I made a bit of a song and dance following some of my more expert colleagues about the fact that although the dividing engines of Ramsden and Troughton in the 1770s and 80s look like the automation of skill, they break the supply crisis for sextants, and had they not done so, the longitude problem would not have been solved. That's true. Without the comparatively mass distribution of almost identical robust devices, so robust that you could give them to a midshipman, and so robust that you could carry them on the quarterdeck, that process of manufacture does not mean that coaxing, finger skill in the workshops disappears. Right? It doesn't. And it doesn't disappear on board ship, as anyone who's ever tried to determine longitude using a clock and a sextant will tell you. Right? So I think the introduction of figured glass into astronomy from the early 1600s is entirely independent with respect to whether or not particularly skilled individuals play a role or not. Right? However, there's always a however. Right? However, the theme of the first half of today's lecture was the way in which, nevertheless, we do see increasing vigilance directed to persons and persons' labour that up till then had thought to be immeasurable, unquantifiable, or probably irrelevant. So that notice that when Maskelyne observes the difference between Kinnebrook and himself in terms of timing transits, he judges that Kinnebrook is just lazy. By the 1840s, that judgment is metric. Everyone knows what their personal equation is. Right? So although the cause of the personal glycon, of the personal equation, remains in a certain sense moral, it can be managed through discipline. Yeah? That's a very interesting point. It seems to me highly resonant with the sort of arguments about evangelical and Benthamite models of moral economy that Boyd has talked about in The Age of Atonement. It's no coincidence that this is George Airy, that thoroughly Anglo-Saxon man, unquote, who is imposing this system of discipline, given A, that he does that for calculators, two, B, he thinks, quote, observing is a job for an idiot, unquote, and C, he is not only suffering from hemiopsy and astigmatism, but he discovered them. So not a reliable observer. And I apologize for leaving out Hevelius, but I have to say I've left out every single Polish astronomer from my time, which is really bad, I agree.